Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. February is Black History Month, and in recognition of that annual celebration, we'll be talking to historian Ira Berlin on American slavery. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. And for this special show, an important event in Black history. On February 21, 1965, at a rally of the Organization of Afro-American Unity, Black leader Malcolm X was gunned down. Always controversial and at times inflammatory, Malcolm X made ridding Blacks of their shame and reminding whites of their blame his life's passion. His powerful message called on Blacks to take responsibility for themselves and each other and to throw off the heavy yoke of white racism. Ironically, Malcolm's most ardent opposition came from his former followers within the Nation of Islam, who were upset with his changing, more accommodating philosophy. After a pilgrimage to Mecca and meeting with white Muslims, Malcolm denounced the philosophy of Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam and vowed to judge white people based on their behavior and not by the color of their skin. For this, he was shot and killed on February 21, 1965, at the age of 39. Turning to items of interest in the news, related to what we just reported in This Week in History, the U.S. Postal Service has announced that Malcolm X is getting his own stamp this year. He's the 22nd person honored in the service's Black History series. And on another Black leader, a scientific test to determine the authenticity of two documents seized by a former FBI agent from accused assassin James Earl Ray's car in 1968 has failed to discredit the document's validity, thereby lending support to those trying to build a case for a conspiracy in the murder of Martin Luther King, Jr. Hidden by the agent for the last 30 years, both documents have the name Raoul written on them, the same name used by the man Ray claims set him up to take the blame for King's murder. You're listening to Talking History.
Glory, glory.
Glory, glory,
hallelujah,
hallelujah,
just right.
My burden down,
my burden down,
my burden down,
glory, glory,
hallelujah,
hallelujah,
just right.
Black history, though given the attention it deserves only in the past few decades, is central to our understanding of American history. Central to Black history is slavery, which Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik talks about today with Ira Berlin. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. Today's program commemorates Black History Month by delving into the topic of slavery, which, 130 years after its abolition, remains a vital topic in American scholarship, politics, and popular culture. Here to analyze the issues in historical perspective is Dr. Ira Berlin, professor of history at the University of Maryland and author of several award-winning books on slavery, including his latest, Many Thousand Gone, the First Two Centuries of Slavery in North America, published by the Harvard University Press. He also was the founding director of the Freedom and Southern Society Project at the University of Maryland and the lead editor of the recently released book audio set combination titled Remembering Slavery, published by the New Press. Welcome, Dr. Berlin.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Starting with the obvious, slavery is really a generic term. As you've shown in your works, actually many varieties of slavery existed. Would you explain a few of the variants?
Well, slavery is in fact a generic term, but it's also a specific term. It refers to ownership of human beings, this process of making people into property. But nonetheless, there are a number of distinct types, and the distinction which I make in Many Thousands Gone is the distinction between what I call societies with slaves and slave societies. And what I mean by societies with slaves is societies in which slavery is but one of many forms of social relationships, one of many forms of labor relationships. It may be mixed in with varieties of servitude, indentured servitude, or servitude for debt. It may be mixed in with wage labor. It may be mixed in with family labor. And all of these are competing forms of social relationships, none of which is necessarily dominant, and certainly the slave relationship is not dominant in what I call societies with slaves. Slave societies, on the other hand, the slave relationship is the dominant relationship, and it becomes both a model and a metaphor for other social relationships, so that the slave relationship informs the relationships between husbands and wives, between parents and children, between workers of all kind, between rulers and ruled. Makes for a very different kind of social relations. Now, of course, the societies with slaves in the New World are largely plantation societies, and of course the plantation and the creation of the plantation generally is the moment, the occasion for this transformation of one to the other.
Mm-hmm. I also remember from reading your books that in these plantation societies, the actual experience of a slave would certainly differ depending on time and place and crop. Could you explain that?
Oh, sure. Both within both of these kinds, societies with slaves and slave societies, the nature of slavery differs by a variety of causes, some of which have to do with the geography, some of which have to do with the topography, with the demography, the population dynamics, and some of which has to do with simply the work people do. So that one would say on a tobacco plantation in Virginia, where the units were relatively small, rarely over 10 or 11 on what Virginia planters called a quarter, but sometimes extending to 20. One could imagine the social relationships are radically different than on a large rice plantation or a large sugar plantation. And, of course, the work that people did would also be radically different on those two units. That is, tobacco being a crop which was extraordinarily tedious, time-consuming, and rice being a crop, or sugar being a crop, which were extraordinarily demanding in other ways, very hard and very wearing on the laborers. The hierarchy, the organization of labor, of course, would be different on a relatively small unit than a large unit. On sugar and rice plantations, we have a hierarchy where there's slaves are governed by drivers who aren't black, of slaves who rise to the rank of supervisors and who are in turn governed by white overseers, who are in turn governed by a white steward who may have charge of several plantations, who are in turn governed by a master who may or may not be in residence. On tobacco plantations, much smaller, probably slaves are working in the field alongside of their owner. So one can imagine the dynamic of social relationships in those circumstances are radically different, even though both are, of course, slavery.
Mm-hmm. And then I also recall Americans are used to the frontier as an image in American history, and I was taken by your discussion of slavery as a part of that frontier and how it affected the slave's life.
Well, slavery was often on the frontier. In some ways, slavery is a pioneering relationship.
And especially, I was thinking in terms of your discussion of the advancing cotton kingdom, into the Black Belt.
Yes, and I was going to address my remarks precisely to that. But
okay.
I mean, you're right. In I think your initial impulse, we normally think of the frontier and Turnerian terms, in terms of opportunity, in terms of expansion of democracy, in terms of greater freedom for footloose and adventurous whites and white families who are anxious to escape more settled societies and looking for greater opportunities. Well, the frontier had exactly the opposite meaning for black people and for slavery. Generally, what it meant, of course, separation from your family as you were sent out to the frontier. Often it meant a much harsher a regime as land had to be broken, as this new crop had to be put in. Cotton made very different demands than did tobacco or rice, that is the main crops of the eastern seaboard. So one had to relearn a whole work regimen. And of course, slaveholders used this change of work regimen as an opportunity to ratchet up labor demands. And, of course, create yet new disciplinary demands on slaves. So the frontier is a kind of classic example of how the experiences of whites and blacks differed radically in 19th century America.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, then, this differential between blacks and whites. As I mentioned in the introduction, your most recent work is titled Remembering Slavery. Have whites and blacks remembered slavery differently?
Well, I think they certainly have thought about slavery in different terms. But I guess, and of course, for most black people, in the United States today, it's something which plays a large part of in their past, and which, of course, shaped the history of their families. And of course, that history is not that far in the distant past. One of the things, of course, remembering slavery is composed of interviews with former slaves done during the 1930s and 1940s. These people were old in 1930 and 1940, but one can easily imagine that if they had children, those children would be alive today. So one can go from today back to slave times in two jumps, literally two generational jumps, and you're back in slave times. And in this, of course, I think for many black people, slavery is not an ancient institution, not a distant institution, but one of immediate relevance. That's not true, of course, for most people of European descent. Now, having said that, having said the experience of whites and blacks in thinking about slavery is different, I would add and emphasize that it is different for black people. It is not all the same for all black people, and just as it is not all the same for all white people. There are many whites who live with the memory of slavery in their family and the experience of slavery, whether that experience was as slaveholders, whether that experience was as people who lived in slave societies, whether that experience was people who defended and fought to defend and died in enormous numbers defending slave societies during the Great Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of your comments on the immediacy, that struck me. Of course, today, many commentators blame slavery for virtually every problem affecting poor African Americans. Is there really a direct connection between slavery and problems facing some African Americans today?
Well, I think, you have to address that question again in a twofold way. I would be very cautious about telescoping our history of seeing a direct connection of the contemporary racial concerns of Americans, black and white, and tracing them all back to slavery. There are many intermediate places along the way. There's Reconstruction, the attempt to transform American society on a more egalitarian basis, and its failure during the post-Civil War years. There's the era of Jim Crow and the creation of the segregation system. And, of course, in our for the 20th century, there's the struggle for equality and the civil rights movement, which which climaxes in the 1960s. And, of course, we now have almost 30 years of experience under our belt since the civil rights era. So I think it would be a great mistake to telescope our history and to see every part of our present racial dilemma and our present racial crisis connected to slavery. Nonetheless, I think slavery is an important cause. As others have said, a kind of original sin, which in some ways we continue to live with and have to deal with.
Let me ask you.
That we haven't dealt with it, of course, weighs very heavily upon us.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to respond to a specific kind of example. Recently, the press has been filled with stories arguing the merits of whether or not DNA testing has conclusively proven that Thomas Jefferson fathered a child or children with his slave Sally Hemings. How widespread were these master-slave sexual liaisons, and what kind of an impact do you think it had on the African-American family?
Well, I mean, we'll never know how widespread it is for obvious reasons, but I would say that the presumption of the master, as indeed many powerful men throughout history, was that one of the attributes of power, one of the presumptions of power, was you had access to women of a subordinate status, in this case, slave women. That was, I think, a presumption that many slaveholders had, and they, and those associated with them, younger sons, overseers, stewards, and so on, also shared that presumption, so that slave women are always liable for sexual abuse. And of course, if we take a look at the contemporary makeup of the American population, one of the things that we know is that we're all mixed up as a population. That is, we're a product of Africa and Europe. And at least part of that product is a product of the relationship between master and slave women. Now, that's the only part of the product. The other parts are, you know, relationships among people of African descent, of European descent, which are much more egalitarian. And, of course, to go back to the master-slave relationship, that relationship also, too, could be complicated. Often it was very brutal and horrific rape, but often it led to relationships which, in fact, were a very loving, and all manners of relationships between those two poles. Probably nothing is more complicated, as we know from contemporary events, than sexual relationships between men and men and women. And the relationship between master and slave certainly speaks to that.
Okay. Now, in the minute that we have left, last year a bill was introduced into the United States Congress that proposed to give an official United States government apology for slavery. Do you support such an apology?
Well, I think the first thing to say about such an apology, which may in fact have already been given by President Clinton when he visited Goree, at least some conservative congressmen think he gave that apology, because when he returned, they demanded he apologize for the apology. But I think perhaps what it should be said is that an apology should be accompanied by an understanding, a full understanding, what we're apologizing for. I think that's probably the most critical aspect on the table. We have to understand something about the institution of slavery, its effect on both master and slave, and the descendants of master and slave, and the rest of us who are Americans, who are inheritors of the fact that for most of our history, we were a slave society.
Well, thank you. And I would recommend to our audience your two fine books, Many Thousand Gone and Remembering Slavery, as a way to begin to understand this highly complex issue. I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Ira Boleyn of the University of Maryland.
Should the United States government formally apologize for slavery? It's more than an academic question. Last year, Congress debated the matter but took no action. It will quite likely take up the matter again this year. You just heard Ira Boleyn's response to the question. Here to offer another perspective is historian Howard Jones. Jones is university professor and chair of the Department of History at the University of Alabama. He's the author of Mutiny on the Amistad, which provided historical background for the movie Amistad.
Should there be an apology for slavery? Yes, I believe there should be. Such an apology could begin a much-needed healing process for the millions of African men, women, and children who were victimized by the Middle Passage to the New World. There is nothing more tragic than to deny a person's inherent right to freedom, to his or her God-given right of liberty that rests on the mere fact of that person's having been born. I have always believed that the first step toward resolving a problem is to talk about it, to create a dialogue that explores the roots of that problem and airs its differences. The Tuskegee apology was a step toward righting a great wrong, although it by no means balanced the ledger. Regarding African slavery, how can one balance the millions of lives lost in a slave trade that lasted hundreds of years? We still feel the aftershocks of slavery today, black people still searching for the roots, while white apologists for slavery continue to claim its benign influence and, yes, even its civilizing virtues. But an apology for African slavery requires the involvement of more than Americans. It would include Arabs as well as Europeans, the Portuguese, Dutch, Spanish, French, English, those who opened the African slave trade and made it into an economic foundation of the Industrial Revolution. And it would also include those African middlemen who brokered the business from within the continent. It is true that the United States absorbed only 7% of those Africans who came to the New World as slaves. And it is also true that excessive cruelty towards slaves as property made no sense, and that perhaps critics exaggerated the abuse. But please do not misinterpret me. Doing less of a wrong does not lessen the wrong. Human bondage, no matter how kind the treatment, is a gross violation of the divine right of freedom. Numbers are not the point. One enslaved human being is one too many. One instance of brutality is one too many. Any system that enslaves people and permits barbaric practices, regardless of their number, is corrupt. The very nature of a republic means that all its citizens bear responsibility for the existence of a great social wrong, whether or not they actively practice it. This was the central problem encountered by the abolitionists of the 19th century and by the civil rights activists of the 20th century, to awaken the national conscience, to make the great masses of American people realize that a great social wrong existed and that their very silence condoned that wrong. With good reason, the abolitionists in 1839 welcomed the arrival of the Amistad blacks in New England as a providential occurrence. They seized upon the case to expose the evils of the slave trade and slavery itself by having the captives tell their story in the highest public forums in the land, the newspapers, in public exhibitions, the courts. The civil rights leaders of the succeeding century pursued the same strategy, exposing the evils of segregation in the highest public forums in the land, in mass demonstrations, the newspapers, radio, TV, and again, the courts. Most important, both reform groups sought to expose the racism that underlay both slavery and segregation, a racism that has permeated the entire country to the present day. Indeed, racism is not merely the central burden of Southern history, but of American history. It was and is a national matter. That said, it follows that an apology should come at the national level, from the executive office in conjunction with Congress and the United States Supreme Court. Admittedly, an apology would not appeal to everyone, particularly those who dismiss slavery as a cause of the Civil War. But I have to agree with President Abraham Lincoln, who suspected that somehow slavery lay at the root of our great sectional conflict. During the 1850s, Lincoln warned that a house divided against itself could not stand. The antebellum American Republic had exalted both liberty and slavery, building a house that came crumbling down in 1861. One can remove stereotypes only by confronting them and exposing them for what they are, distorted perceptions of reality. The house about which Lincoln spoke in the mid-19th century remains divided. We are still in the process of closing the gap between morality and the law, between what we preach and what we practice. We have made great strides toward racial equality, but the struggle is not over. We can take an important step toward true racial equality by extending a national apology for slavery. Such a bold measure might promote a time of healing and perhaps at long last lay the slavery issue to rest.
You've been listening to Howard Jones, University Professor and Chair of the Department of History at the University of Alabama and the author of Mutiny on the Amistad. Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, we call to your attention the online exhibit, The African American Mosaic, at the Library of Congress. The exhibit offers a sampling of the many books, periodicals, prints, photographs, music, films, and recorded sounds in the library's collection, covering the nearly 500 years of the black experience in the Western Hemisphere. African American Mosaic is available at the Library of Congress website. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. If the Maroons, as escaped slaves in the Caribbean were known, had been defeated, meaningful black resistance to the indignity and cruelty of African slavery would have ended, wrote Colonel Colin Lloyd George Harris, leader of the Windward Maroons in Moortown, Jamaica. Though defeated in specific uprisings and particular battles, Maroons continued their resistance to slavery for four centuries throughout the Americas. Their story will be told in the exhibit Creativity and Resistance, Maroon Cultures in the Americas. The exhibit includes historical documentation and many fine examples of Maroon cultural expression. It opens at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee on March 20th, and after 2 months moves on to other venues around the United States. For information on the exhibit and its schedule, contact the National Civil Rights Museum. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when we will take a look at the mythical island of Atlantis. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day when I saw the birds come around.